Today's guest introduces us to everyday people who, out of adversity, have exhibited great resilience, often unaware themselves of who they really are. What kinds of diversities, how common are these challenges, and how does resilience become a part of the experience? Hello, everyone. I'm Dr. Pamela Brewer, welcoming you to this edition of Mind Talk, and absolutely delighted to introduce to you Dr. Meg Jay, who is the author of Supernormal, The Untold Story of Adversity and Resilience. Hello, Dr. Jay. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
I'm curious, before we get into sort of the nuts and the bolts of Supernormal, what encouraged you to write this book?
You know, I wrote Supernormal because I, maybe like yourself, I work with people behind closed doors all day, every day. And what I found was that so many people felt alone with similar problems. So I work with people one at a time, and I can't tell you how many times I've heard, I feel so isolated, I feel so alone, I feel so lonely with this experience. And when I hear that enough times about similar experiences, that tells me someone needs to bring this conversation more out into the public. And I felt like with a book, it could bring the conversation out of therapy offices and more into the public domain, especially for people who may not be willing or able to see a therapist, or, you know, may not be at a university where they might learn about some of these topics. I wanted the conversation to be there for everyone.
Well, certainly in recent times, there has been so much in the news. Well, actually, the news sort of breeds bad news, right? I mean, that's what makes the news popular, quote unquote. But there's been so much for really an extended period of time. And I just wonder what your thoughts are on the impact of such chronic bad news on individuals?
Well, I mean, really what I think a lot of people are experiencing as adults right now, you know, with the news cycle, is not that different from what a lot of people maybe also experienced as kids, or what, you know, many kids and teens are experiencing right now who are growing up with adversity. If you have an alcoholic parent in the home, or a mentally ill sibling in the home, or a bully around your corner, then every day you wake up wondering what's going to happen today, or you're still worrying about what happened the day before, and that life feels very unpredictable and very dangerous. And that's living with chronic stress. And we know that living with chronic stress is not so great for our bodies and our minds, that it's, you know, really like living in a low level of fight or flight all the time, which takes its toll both emotionally and physically.
You make the point in Supernormal that so many Americans face life-changing adversity before the age of 20, and I'm not sure that we all are as aware of that as we really need to be. Before the age of 20.
That's right. Yes. So I think one of the most damaging outcomes of adversity or side effects is that they tend to make people feel isolated and alienated. And if you think about what I write about in Supernormal are the 10 most common adversities that children and teens grow up with. So I'll try to rattle them off quickly, but that's losing a parent to death or to divorce, substance abuse in the home, bullying, mental illness in the home, physical, emotional, or sexual abuse, growing up with poverty or neglect, having a parent in jail, or witnessing domestic violence. So these are the 10 most common adversities. And if you think of each one individually, each one just impacts a minority of the population, whether that's 5% here, 20% there. But if you think of them collectively under the umbrella of childhood adversity, 75% of people will grow up with one of these or more, as often one adversity in your home or in your neighborhood or community increases your likelihood for also experiencing another and another. And so, ironically, most people who grow up with one of the adversities that I mentioned, they feel different from other people. They feel outside of the normal. But sadly, these adversities are the norm. And in that, I just mean that that's common, that it's actually uncommon to have a life that isn't touched by significant adversity by the time you're 20.
So when you say that when someone experiences an adversity, they're more likely to experience another and another, there would be some people who would say, aha, those are built-in victims and they're just looking for a hard time. But that's not the case.
Oh, no, not at all. That it's really more of, so I opened the book with a particular story about a woman who grew up in a home where when she was a kid, her brother drowned in the backyard pool. That was, it was an accident. They, lived a couple of hours outside of San Francisco in a, small suburban neighborhood. It was just an accident that the brother drowned. And after that, the mom became depressed and the father started drinking too much. And then years later, the father actually committed suicide. And you hear stories like that where, and I think the very next chapter, I talk about a family that goes through a pretty bad divorce. And the father sort of leaves the picture. And then after that, the mom really struggles financially. The whole family struggles financially. So it's really more of the case, not that people are asking for repeated adversities, but that one hardship makes you more vulnerable to the next and the next. So I think the studies have shown if you experience one significant hardship as a child, you're 50% more likely to experience another by the time you're 20. And that, most people or many people are going to see somewhat of a snowball effect there.
And so that is the nature of the hardship, not the nature of the individual.
Absolutely. And these individuals, I'm talking about are kids and teens, in the beginning of their stories. So they're not, causing the problems in the first place. But even in the situations that I talk about, I'm thinking about another chapter or another situation where I talk about girl who grows up in a home where her sibling has mental illness, and then that leads to a lot of other stressful situations. But it's just often the case that if you grow up with one significantly tough time, then you just become more vulnerable. Your family, your environment is more vulnerable to other stresses, especially as so having a mentally ill sibling puts a lot of stresses on finances, because often parents need to work less or one parent has to stop working to take care of the child. And so these aren't bad life choices people are making. These are, unfortunately, the, sort of the negative outcomes of living with serious adversity.
I was struck early on, you tell the story of Helen, and I was struck by the difference between your definition of resilience and hers. Can you share that?
Right.
With
well,
us?
Well, that was really one reason that I wanted to write the book, was that I, work every day with people who are actually quite successful as adults, but often they have a secret, and or they have some experience from their background that they feel like other people don't know about, or that the people that they live around now, whether they work with every day or they live next door to, or they're, partnered with, wouldn't necessarily understand, that maybe they didn't have that background. And when I, see people like this who have turned out, better than you might have expected based on the times that they grew up with, almost every time when I've asked them, these clients, do you consider yourself to be resilient? They almost always say no. And they kind of look at me funny and look around the office like I must be confused. And they say, well, no, if I was resilient, I wouldn't need you. Or if I was resilient, I wouldn't be here. And I think, if we think about how we think about resilience in everyday conversation, we say people who are resilient, they bounce back or they rebound. And so there's this sense that resilient people aren't impacted by hard times at all, that they just manage to forge ahead as if nothing's really wrong. And that's not actually what it's like to be resilient. I mean, that's not really how people overcome adversity. It's just by not being touched by it at all. But it's interesting how culturally, I think that's how we talk about it. And it comes up a lot, actually, around having written this book. People will say, oh, you wrote a book about resilience. I need to read that and find out how people do that. And I understand the impulse of, you know, we all want to be more resilient, but people imagine there's this formula, and if you had it, you could, you know, be successful and never have hard times have an impact on you. And that's not what you hear resilient people actually say that their experience was.
You identify well-known people as you talk about resilience. Maya Angelou, Stephen Colbert, Viola Davis, Johnny Carson. Can you give us sort of a thumbnail sketch of what their lives were like that allows them to be in your book?
Well, what I did was I wanted to include public figures in the book. And, you know, the book is really, as you said, it's about everyday people. And, the most in-depth, you know, emotionally rich stories are my clients' stories. You know, they're everyday people who've done well after growing up with hard times. But I wanted to include public figures in the book because I wanted my clients and people like my clients out there to see that if they're out there struggling, that if they grew up with something that wasn't so great and they're out there struggling to get themselves to a better place, to see that they're not alone, that they're in good company. And I only used people for whom I could find memoirs or interviews that it was, you know, that you could hear, you know, public figures talk themselves about what it was like for them to get from adversity to resilience. And what you hear in the stories that I include was that it wasn't easy, that it was very difficult, that it took a long time, that they really struggled, that they really suffered early on. And then, of course, you know, people like Oprah Winfrey and Maya Angelou and Stephen Colbert and Andre Agassi, they get to these amazing, phenomenal places, but they really talk about how they struggled along the way and that it wasn't as easy on the inside as maybe it looked on the outside. And I felt it was important for people to hear that.
Give us a sense of a couple of these individuals and what the issues were that they were able to move through. Your choice, Maya, Stephen, Viola, Johnny Carson, Andre Agassi.
Right.
Your choice.
I love Viola Davis's story, and she's only recently begun to talk publicly about how she grew up. But she grew up with a father who was an alcoholic and an abuser. And she also grew up in a white working class neighborhood where she was subject to racial violence. And so she grew up with a lot of chronic stress, a lot of poverty, that she said that her most reliable meal was school lunch. And yet look at her now, that it's really hard to reconcile the kind of child she had with the kind of success she's experiencing now. I mean, we all know Oprah Winfrey's story, being sexually abused when she was younger and really struggling for some time after that, but then finding her way through journalism and her love of words and literature and her personality and making her way out of that. Stephen Colbert, his father and two brothers were killed together in a plane crash when he was a boy. And he talks about that, getting to this place of contradiction, which is where a lot of people who are resilient find themselves. I think a quote that he has is, you know, I've learned to love what I most wish had never happened, meaning that he has, you know, accepted or appreciated the way that it's helped him grow as a person. Yet he wishes, of course, that that had never happened, that he would, you know, give it all back if he could have his father and his brothers back. And so, you know, I think when we look at successful people, we imagine that they had charmed lives or they had these, you know, so-called average upbringings that we hear about. But in reality, not that many people have had that average upbringing that we hear about. And there are people all around us who have these amazing stories. Maybe they're our teachers or our doctors or artists or neighbors or aunts or uncles who, you know, whose backstory would surprise you.
In fact, you say that most resilient people are everyday people just hiding in plain sight.
That's right. And I really wanted, so in the book, I talk about the 10 most common adversities because I wanted to write a book that would wrap its arms around resilient people in general. So most of the time you read a book that's for adult children of alcoholics, or a different book which is for sexual abuse survivors, and still that keeps people separated in these little groups where they feel not as good as other people or different than other people. And I wanted to write a book that said, I see you, I see so many people hiding in plain sight with maybe not the same backstory, but with a similar trajectory in terms of growing up with some significant difficulty and finding your way to survive and then to thrive. And that, you know, those people are all around us.
You term those people, as is the name of your book, supernormal. Why supernormal?
Well, supernormal was a word that I read. I was looking at some old research back from the 70s or 80s when people first started kind of looking into, you know, resilient kids. And someone called them, just in a like a line in a book, supernormal. And as soon as I read it, I thought, that's it. That's the word that I want to use. Because like I said, if you use the word resilient with people like the clients that I was mentioning, you know, the woman who, you know, her brother died and her father became an alcoholic and then he killed himself. And, you know, she really worked hard to get to where she was. If you use the word resilient with people like that, it often just, it doesn't hit, because they think, well, no, it hasn't been as easy as it would be if I were really resilient. And so my experience is that word does not resonate with people. But so I wanted to play with a different word, and supernormal means, you know, above the normal or average. And the people that I'm talking about have better than average outcomes after adversity. They beat expectations. They beat the odds. And what I liked about the word supernormal is that it hints at how heroic that is, that it changes the way people might think about themselves, even just for the period of time of reading the book, from thinking about themselves as abnormal, as different in a bad way because of the things that they've been through, to thinking of themselves as supernormal, as exceptional, in that it's pretty amazing the ways they've found to survive and thrive.
And even on the cover of Supernormal is that red cape that we all know so well.
Yeah, so the kind of the central metaphor for the book is the superhero story. And if you think about it, you know, the superhero story, you've got someone who often, when they were younger, had some kind of event, you know, an origin story that changed the trajectory of their life, and that they, you know, from then on, kind of are living their lives in fight or flight. They're dodging bullets, they're leaping over buildings, they're trying to, you know, battle back against the dangers around them. And this is all exactly what resilient people do. And, you know, many grow up and feel the impulse to put on the cape and say, I'm going to go out, I'm going to do some good in the world, and I'm going to help people the way that I maybe wish I had been helped. And, you know, another bit about the superhero story that I take up in Supernormal is that often superheroes struggle to find love, that they might find success, you know, in the superhero workplace, and that they're Superman, they're Spider-Man, they're Batman, they're out there doing amazing things. Yet oftentimes relationships can be, you know, really the last area where they struggle, and they can be the most difficult places to be brave, is to figure out, who can I come home to at the end of the day and let them know me just as me?
We're going to take a break, folks, but you are listening to Dr. Meg Jay, who is the author of Supernormal, The Untold Story of Adversity and Resilience. We'll be back in just a moment. Jay, you just mentioned the difficulty that some folks have with finding romantic joy. What's that about?
Well, I think for all of, I mean, I think for most people, it's probably easier to figure out, you know, to read a book about succeeding at work or succeeding at school and figuring out how to go out and do that, especially if you're, you know, a scrappy survivor. I think when you've grown up, and, you know, most people who grow up with adversity are harmed in the context of relationships. So it's either was, you know, a parent who drank too much, or a sibling who was abusive, or, you know, someone at school who was a bully, or a coach who was sexually abusive. So oftentimes relationships are where it can be most difficult to be brave. And, you know, for resilient people who have worked so hard to survive, and they're sort of living their lives in a low level of fight or flight every day, you have to move out of that to find love. I mean, you can't find love while you're living in fight or flight. And that can be a difficult shift to make, to move into not in, you know, out of surviving and into thriving of, can I just let my guard down and try again to let people get close or see if someone will treat me differently or better than maybe I saw that I was treated when I was younger.
You know, it was just a sort of off the cuff comment that you just made, which I think is a really powerful one. So I just want to go back to it for a moment. You indicated that most people who have experienced trauma, those traumas have in some ways been connected to relationships of one kind or another, which just in saying that, it sort of opens up, I would suspect, the listener's viewpoint about trauma, about resilience, and about how they themselves might, in fact, be one of those resilient folks. Because we've all had relationships of one kind or another with one kind of person or another.
Right. And it's if you look at the research around, you know, there is no hierarchy of trauma. A lot of people want to know what's the worst trauma, what's the worst adversity, which is the best one. Right. And of course, there is no best or worst, but there are certain factors that go into, you know, what makes it. Two of the things that help us recover from adversity, one is talking about it to someone, and the other is having people who care. And what we know is that when there are adversities that don't feel interpersonal, so if I were in a hurricane or a tornado, or even if you know, let's say if you have a parent pass away, which of course we recognize as a profound childhood trauma, those events at least usually seem like accidents of unfortunate circumstances, not as something, you know, intentional that someone did to harm us. And so what can make trauma that feels very interpersonal in nature, whether that's an alcoholic parent or, you know, a coach who's sexually abusive, it can make those difficult to kind of recover from and to try relationships afterward, because they feel very personal, they're hard to talk about, and so that kind of keeps other people out of our lives. Whereas some adversities that are out in the open for everyone to see, then you almost can't help but talk about it with people, and they talk about it with you.
I see. You say that supernormals use anger to feel empowered and optimistic. How does that work?
Well, you know, anger has a bad reputation, and, you know, it's one of the seven universal emotions. I mean, we're evolutionarily wired to use anger when necessary, and it has a function, and its function is to help us say, ow, that hurt. I don't like that. I'm mad. And so what you see a lot of supernormals or a lot of resilient people do with their anger is they use it to resist, to push back against the situation in their life. That instead of saying, well, I guess this is what I deserve, or well, I guess this is all there is for me, they say, no, I don't accept this. I'm not doing this. I'm not living this way anymore. Or when I'm 18, I'm getting out of here, and I'm not living this way as an adult. And so that's actually anger talking. That's anger saying, I don't like this. I don't accept this. I push back against this. And obviously, you know, what resilient people do is they find a productive use of their anger, that they channel that into action that helps them get out of their situation, that helps them survive their situation. And then sometimes, you know, they take it into their careers or into their volunteer work and say, I'm not going to sit by and have other people go through what I went through. I don't accept that either. And so there can be very healthy uses of anger, but that's especially when we couple it with purposeful ethical action.
I'd like for you to go into a bit more detail about Sam's story and the impact of divorce on him. And also, you talk mm-hmm. about Sam having had flashbulb memories, and I'd like you to go into that as well.
Yeah, so Sam is, he's in the second chapter of the book, and his adversity is was that he had a pretty awful divorce in his family. I mean, his parents went through a pretty awful divorce, and he didn't see, you know, after a certain point, he just didn't see his father anymore. His father moved away, and that was that. And I actually chose Sam specifically to start the book with because, not because every divorce is an adversity, but because I think because divorce is so common that we almost forget that for some kids it is an adversity, and that even if it's for the best or even if it's the right situation for a couple, it can still be painful for our kids. And that actually, if you want to help your child through a divorce, understanding that even if it's for the best, it still can hurt, is a lot more helpful than saying this is for the best, it's all upside, because that's not usually the way kids feel. And so I wanted to talk about Sam to start the book there, that I'm not talking about extreme outlier adversities here. I'm talking about everyday adversities that are real and serious. And so in Sam's family, his father left, and he had a lot of emotional memories around that, you know, the last time he saw him, or maybe, you know, the only time he saw him after that, or what it was like when he would get a card from him in the mail. And some people call these flashbulb memories because they're memories that are so emotional that our brains almost take pictures of them to say, hey, don't forget this. This really stood out. It's a highly emotional moment. And sometimes these are great, happy moments, like, you know, some amazing birthday or maybe your wedding day. But oftentimes our brain pays special attention to really painful moments. So Sam had a good collection of some really, really painful memories around the time of his parents' divorce. And those were memories that just weren't talked about when he was younger because it was too upsetting for his mother to hear about how hurtful it was for Sam. And then he felt like he kept him to himself his whole life. And that actually, as an adult, what he was experiencing is what is called disenfranchised grief. And that is that he only realized as an adult, really, you know, both in therapy, but also in his relationship with his girlfriend, that he had lost a parent too. You know, it was as if his father died because he went out of his life and never came back. But it wasn't something that people recognized as a legitimate loss. It wasn't something he was, you know, obviously there was no funeral. It wasn't something he was able to grieve. And so he had all these really upsetting, very painful memories that just seemed really central to him that he had never been able to share with someone else. But once he was able to do that, then he was able to, they could sort of take up less of the energy in his brain, and he was able to pay more attention to other memories, better, happier times that, you know, that were happening for him in the present.
You talk about Sam at one point as realizing that the men who had been significant to him in his life were all gone, and you list his father, God, and Santa Claus. That's an interesting trio of missing people.
Well, yes. Well, that was how he remembered it. So I think in the same year period, there was those three men in his life, you know, those three male figures in his life were gone, in that his dad you know, left sort of early one morning before, you know, he got up to go to school, that his dad walked out the door, and Sam actually heard him going, and he tiptoed out of his room and saw him leave. And then later that year, he was reading the Bible and read some things in there that, you know, didn't have nice things to say about people who were divorced, or, and so that made Sam feel like he didn't want to read the Bible anymore. And then at the very end of that year, his mother was actually doing the, you know, getting the Santa presents together on Christmas Eve, and Sam had come downstairs to get water or something, and he saw her doing it. And so that, you know, so there went his believing in Santa Claus. And so I think, you know, for Sam, what that all represented was a year in which he went from having, you know, these sort of three male figures that were important to him as a child, you know, as a, I believe he's maybe 10 years old in that year, to then losing the ability to believe in those figures as, you know, sort of good or, you know, happy childhood figures to hold on to, that suddenly they were gone. And he felt that he was, you know, left alone with his mom, who then really struggled to make it financially after the father was gone.
You know, it underscores an interesting preference, if you will, for parents when they're talking to their children with the goal of eliminating, you know, the Easter Bunny and Santa Claus and the Tooth Fairy and all of that, to be mindful of the fact that these figures have meaning for that child. And so it's important to really be thoughtful about how you remove those figures.
That's right. That you'll see that, you know, that kids, you know, obviously kind of age out. They get to this point where they sort of start to realize maybe it doesn't make the most logical sense in the world that, you know, Santa's able to do all this, or that, you know, there's a bunny who delivers eggs. And so kids usually figure that out at about the right time for them, you know, cognitively, when they're mature enough to realize this doesn't really make that much sense. But oftentimes you can see kids, you know, for a year or two in there, where they're old enough to realize this doesn't make sense, but you can tell they don't want to stop believing yet. And, you know, if we as parents have set up this, you know, this kind of this magic around these figures and this specialness, I do think kids, you know, if they're fortunate enough to kind of come to this at the right time for them, is certainly better than, you know, finding out accidentally or in somewhat of a thoughtless way before they're ready. But, you know, I think with a lot of parents, you know, I mean, the truth is a lot of families will go through a divorce. And I think the takeaway for me, both in Sam's story, but in other clients I've had whose lives felt changed because of divorce, or even the research I did for that chapter, was that the point isn't that divorce is bad and should never happen, but that it's painful most of the time. That kids will tell you, even if the kids, you know, that they looked at it in, you know, research around divorce, will say, I knew it was the best thing for my family, but I was still really sad. And that if we just let that be true, then we're helping our child more than if we need to protect ourselves from their sadness of saying, no, this is for the best, and I'll have two houses and two bicycles and two sets of friends, and it's all the better. Then what's happening is that we're not giving kids just a place where they feel like they could talk about that, hey, they're sad, but that it's maybe for the best and that we'll find our way through it. But yes, it's painful.
You know, so many times I think that adults forget that children, too, can be sad or anxious or depressed or lonely. I think we tend to just sort of routinely attach those, our sense of those experiences, to adults and forget that children experience them as well.
Yes, I think sometimes we forget, and I think even more maybe, I think it's very hard for parents to see their kids suffer or to be unhappy, you know, and especially maybe there's something culturally now where we feel like kids have to sort of be happy or succeed all the time. And know, that's just not reality, and that that, you know, we help our kids more by, like you're saying, recognizing that, you know, they have the seven universal emotions too. Happiness is only one of them, and the others are, you know, sadness and surprise and anger and disgust, and, you know, that we have to help them have a place where they can, you know, talk about those emotions, experiencing them as part of being human, and that that's how, you know, those emotions pass, is by saying, wow, I'm really feeling this, and somebody saying, I see that, or I hear that, that must be really hard, that we don't have to make our kids happy right away, but that really by allowing them to be sad or allowing them to be angry, it will pass more quickly.
And allowing them to express those feelings.
Yes, I mean, and that's where I think, you know, whether it's having a friend or a relative or a support group or a therapist, I mean, sometimes I think it's hard for parents to hear that something that they're doing is making their child unhappy. And kids know that, so they often keep it to themselves. They don't want to make their parents feel bad. So sometimes I think kids need a place where they can talk about, you know, what's going on with their troubled sibling or what it's like now that their parents have split up or what the case is, to have those conversations and not worry about upsetting or hurting their parents if it's something that parents just can't take hearing.
We're going to take a break, but when we come back, you talk about the process that children and adults will go through where something horrific has happened, but there's a tendency to behave as though everything is fine. And I'd like for you to delve into that a little bit more deeply when we return. And folks, this is Pamela Brewer. You are listening to Mind Talk, and I am having a conversation with Meg J., who is the author of Supernormal, The Untold Story of Adversity and Resilience. Jay, you quote journalist Charles Blow from his memoir in which he said, I had to resort to the most useful and dangerous lesson a damaged child ever learned, how to lie to himself. Is that what children and adults are doing when they will tend to act as though everything is fine when in fact they've just experienced a traumatic event?
Yes. I mean, it's, you know, that it's interesting. We think about, you know, people, so many of my clients come into my office, you know, in their 20s or 30s or 40s and say, you know, I've never really talked about this, but, or this is part of my story, but it never occurred to me to bring it up before. And it's not so much that what you'll often see, it's not so much that people have intentionally kept secrets from other people as much as they, like my clients will say, it never occurred to me to talk about this before, that they really are keeping secrets from themselves. And we do this when we're confronted with an experience that seems overwhelming, terrifying, dangerous, difficult to solve, that we almost can't look at it because we realize I don't see a way out of this, so I can't confront that I'm in the corner here. And, you know, that's going to be especially difficult when there isn't language. We don't even know what to call what happened. So if you think about some of the stories in the news recently, women talking about growing up, you know, being sexually abused by coaches or being assaulted or harassed in the workplace, they'll often say, I didn't even know what that was that was happening to me. I just knew there was something, but it was something that I didn't even know what to call it. And that's true for a lot of kids, because kids don't know, they don't know what an alcoholic is, or they don't know what a bipolar parent is, or they don't know, you know, what a sibling who may be sexually abusing them, they don't know what that is. And so, but they have this sense that something is very wrong, and they don't know who to tell. They don't know what to say. They can't imagine how to overcome it. And so they just kind of tuck it away in a part of their brain where it feels both like a secret and like a lie, because there's this sense of that, you know, they wish it wasn't happening. Maybe it isn't happening. I'm not telling other people. I'm inherently a liar because I'm not telling other people what's going on in my life. So it's very, very complicated to grow up, you know, with big secrets buried inside of you.
And you reference stories that we've heard in the news. And one of the common pushback is that if this were really true, if this had really happened, somebody would have said something a very long time ago. What you're saying is not so much, not at all.
Not at all. Absolutely. I mean, and I think that's where, you know, professionals hear that and they say, not at all. That actually the more terrifying, the more threatening, the more confusing, the more frightening an experience, the less likely we will think about it or admit it to ourselves or bring it into conversation with other people, the less likely we'll do that soon or ever. You know, for many people, I mean, you're hearing people now who say, haven't really talked about this much for 30 years or 15 years or 10 years. And that's actually more common than not.
I think that's so important for people to hear, that it is more common than not when something traumatic happens that you don't talk about it, that you keep it inside. That's such an important piece of understanding that we all need to have.
It is. And, you know, I won't tell the whole story now, but it's in the book and I included it. It's about the Chowchilla bus kidnapping back in the 70s. And I include the story. I'll just tell a little bit of it now because I think it does such a great job of illustrating what happens when people are overwhelmed and terrified. So it was the story about in Chowchilla, California, a group of kids on a school bus. Their school bus was taken over. They were kidnapped. Somebody got on their bus, took the kids, put them in these like windowless vans, drove them around, then actually buried them underground as a group in this big kind of moving van bunker underground and left them there to die. And they actually escaped and, you know, made it out. However, when they talked about their experience and the time that they were being driven around by these kidnappers for hours, and these are small children, we're talking about first graders, second graders, they had no food, they had no water, many of them were sitting in their own urine, they were riding around in these vans and they were singing, if you're happy and you know it, clap your hands. And that is a classic trauma reaction, in that what's going on is so bizarre, so terrifying, so impossible to understand that they just proceed as if nothing's wrong. And they just went on with what first graders would do. If you drove them around in a van for 2 hours, they would probably sing songs and clap their hands. And later when they were able to escape and made it to, you know, they were taken to this facility and checked out, that, you know, everybody said, wow, they look great. They seemed fine. And they actually weren't fine, but it took quite some time for it to become clear that this experience had had a big impact. Most people saw that as their origin story or the most defining moment of their lives, even though at the time they literally acted as if none of this was happening. But that's what people do when they're really terrified or really overwhelmed. They just kind of pretend like it's not going on, and it can take some time before you say, hey, wait a minute, this isn't right, or that harmed me. That can take years.
And I would suggest also being able to think about it or talk about it with someone who can really honor not only the experience, but the fear that kept you so silent, fear and so many other feelings that would keep one so silent for so long.
Well, right. So, you know, most people, you know, keep things to themselves, at least in part, because they're worried about, well, what will happen if I tell? Will I be in trouble? Will my family be in trouble? Will I lose my job? You know, will my coach not like me anymore? Will the bully be worse than before? You know, will my parents, you know, hit me if I talk about their drinking, if I even knew what to call that? So it's hard to even know how to talk about these sorts of problems. But then even if you can imagine how to do that, or you have a person to do that with, you know, kids are smart and they're aware that there can be consequences that could make it even worse than before.
You describe a man named Paul, and you said there was a turning point for Paul in his childhood. Can you share Paul's story with us?
Paul was a boy who was bullied at school, and that went on, you know, really day in and day out for quite some time. And then one day some kids were throwing rocks at him, and they, you know, somebody got him on the side of the head, and he came home kind of bloodied. And his parents were very upset and, you know, didn't know what to do, and they, you know, thought about taking him out and sending him to another school, or maybe they should move away, even though they really couldn't afford to do either of those things. And he said in that moment, you know, that he got angry, and he realized that what was happening was wrong, and that he wasn't going to let it ruin his life. He wasn't going to make his family move over it. He wasn't going to internalize it, that there was just, you know, kind of the fighter within, became a lot stronger that day, and that after that he really pushed back on the inside and on the outside in places where it was safe for him to do that, pushed back against this, you know, what he was being told every day, which was, you know, he was a loser and a nothing and a nobody. But inside he said, I just refused to believe that what they said about me was true, and that he wasn't going to let this ruin his life. And you will often hear people who are resilient say, I remember as a kid just saying, this isn't going to ruin me. This isn't going to define me. And of course, it's harder than just making up your mind about that. But, you know, that's for a lot of people, that's where it starts.
You say for the supernormals, very often their approach is to attack a problem and solve the problem rather than to rage against another person. Why would they take that approach? The problem, not the person?
Well, you know, if you think about it, most kids or teens are in situations that they actually can't necessarily change right away. So if you, you know, live with a parent who's abusive, or you're being bullied at school, which was Paul's situation, or you live with a sibling, you know, who's mentally ill, that oftentimes it's not safe to you know, nor is it really obviously the right thing to do to pick a fight with that person or to battle back against that person. You know, that scene in the movie where the person who's bullied, you know, kind of wins in a fight on the last day of school. And, you know, that's not usually how it goes down. Usually what happens is somebody says, I see that I can't rage against this person who's harming me, and nor would it be wise or right for me to do that, but I can fight back against the situation, that I can find a way to not have this ruin my life, that I can find a way out of this situation, or at least to be exposed less to this situation. And so a lot of you know, resilient people will say they're scrappy, they're problem solvers, they figure out, you know, how to fight back by getting themselves out to a different or better place than where they felt they were being harmed.
And, you know, I think about so many of the books and the people who talk about best communication practices, if you will talk about the need to approach the problem and not to personalize it and make it the individual.
Right. That, you know, for a lot of, I mean, you know, sometimes in stories where, you know, people are growing up with not so great figures in their lives, sometimes there are some obvious bad guys, but oftentimes, you know, it's a sibling who's mentally ill and who can't help what they're doing, or is in equally as a bad situation as you are, just different. Or, you know, that even if a parent who is an alcoholic and may have a lot of problems, but oftentimes kids still love those parents. And so it isn't so easy to say that they can just battle back against that person or write off that person, but rather they say, you know, this is a problem that I need to solve, not a person that I need to fight with.
Again, that's such a, I think, more doable, a healthier way to approach so much of what we deal with just as human beings, even when the person or the person's behavior is the problem.
Right.
It helps us to broaden, perhaps, how we think about things. You say that, and I am quoting you, it is bold to believe that we are deserving of good treatment, not because we have done something good, but simply because we are good. That is such a hard concept for so many people.
It is, and I think it is especially for supernormals, for resilient people who have, you know, many of whom have gotten themselves out of some pretty tough childhoods into better places. And often they've done that because of the A at school or the blue ribbon in swimming or, you know, the award for their artwork or because of their hard work at work or what, you know, that it's the things that they've done that have allowed them to succeed and have allowed them to, you know, kind of be welcomed into new situations or other people's homes. And so I think it can be very hard for people to realize that they're good even without doing all of that, or now that they've gotten themselves to a better place, that they don't have to prove all the time that they're, you know, as good as other people, or they're that they're not abnormal, but that they just are. They're okay and deserving of good treatment already.
And what a piece of difficult to achieve joy for many of us if we could just hold on to that reality.
Well, I have found that is the, you know, that most of the clients, most of the people that I'm talking about in this book, that they get it. You know, they got the A's or they worked really hard and they got themselves to where that, you know, that they feel that they deserve to be where they are in the workplace, maybe, or in school, maybe, or even with friends, but especially in romantic relationships. I think one of the most damaging outcomes or consequences of early adversity is, like I said, that feeling of that you're not normal, that you're different than other people. And so oftentimes that leads people in relationships to sort of, quote, take what they can get or feel like they need to find other people who have had other hard times too, who, you know, may be on a similar path toward resilience, or maybe they're really still struggling. And what that person is doing is joining, you know, based on struggle rather than based on triumph. But it's, I oftentimes see, you know, really heroic people who have overcome so much feel that they deserve so little in relationships because they feel damaged or abnormal because of the way they grew up.
I think another thing that shows up often is the person who, certainly in a relationship, believes that they have to prove themselves worthy in a relationship, and it may be by gift giving, it may be by any number of things, but that they don't
Right.
feel okay in the relationship unless they are working really, really hard to make that other person love them and stay in love with them.
That's right. Or yes, they feel like they, you know, and you see this a lot with kids who grew up in, you know, stressful or dangerous or abusive environments where they're constantly scanning the environment thinking, what do people want from me now? What should I do to appease this parent now? How can I not anger this sibling now? And so they're too good at it. And so by the time they're adults, they may not even realize it, but the way that they're functioning is, you know, what can I do now to make this other person happy or not angry or to keep me around and, you know, not start causing trouble? And that's not, you know, that's not the foundation for a healthy relationship. That's really, you know, some strategic maneuvers to keep other people happy. But then, like you said, that person ends up feeling like they don't really belong in the relationship. They don't really deserve it. Only as long as they're on their best behavior, then Right. Maybe they can continue to pull it off.
Absolutely. Dr. J, there's so much more to discuss about Supernormal and so little time left. Tell folks where they can get more information about you and the work that you're doing and have done.
Well, Supernormal, fortunately, is available everywhere. So it's, you know, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, indie bookstores, iBooks, everywhere. And I wrote the book to help people. I wanted people to feel seen. I wanted people to feel understood. And so I hope that a lot of people, it finds its audience and that people do indeed get that from it. And if you want to know more about me, I have a website. It's megjay.com, megjay.com.
Terrific. And is there information about your book at the website?
Oh, yes. It talks all about the book at the website. So you
Terrific.
Can kind of delve a little bit more into it and click on it from there.
Excellent. Dr. J, thank you so much for the work that you've done and for spending time with us today.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is available on demand by going to myndtalk.org. You can also download the Mind Talk app from iTunes or Google Play. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications, and I'd love to know where in the world you are as you're listening to Mind Talk today. So send me an email to Pamela, Pamela, at mindtalk.org. That's myndtalk.org. And remember always, if it's unacceptable, it's unacceptable. You take care.